This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering, and we start today with a tale of two schools. One closed and then just reopened after nearly four dozen students tested positive for COVID. The other went mask-free for 3 weeks without an increase in cases. So how can both be happening in the same state? WBUR's education reporter Carrie Young has been following both, joins us now in Studio 3. Welcome, Carrie.
Hi, Tiziana.
Great to have you here. So starting with the latest, the first was the Curley School in Jamaica Plain, back in session 12 days after the district closed it following a COVID-19 outbreak. I understand first day back open was yesterday, Monday. How did that go?
From what I understand, the first day back went pretty well. I asked the Boston Teachers Union what they had heard from their staff, and here's how Union Vice President Eric Berg described it to me.
It sounds like attendance is good, and people seem generally like things have gone well.
And Berg adds, you know, it is a little bit early to tell how things are going with COVID mitigation. It's only been 2 days in class, but so far, so good.
So on school days during the closure, Carrie, students learned remotely 7 school days. The state is only going to count 3 of those towards the required 180 days of learning this year. Why?
Yeah, you know, it's not entirely clear, really. The official answer from the Education Commissioner, Jeff Riley, was that he believed that Boston Public Schools could have avoided the situation, potentially, if they were just a little bit better about following state guidance. His official response was noticeably pointed to, saying that while yes, it is possible that this cluster of cases spread so fast that BPS couldn't contain it, he added, though, that, quote, we are left to wonder if the whole school closure could have been avoided if the progressive interventions recommended by DESE were implemented last week, end quote. And Riley did go on to say that there are other things that BPS could have done, like classroom or grade-level quarantining, that could have made a difference, but we don't quite know at this point. I guess it's hindsight. I think another thing at play to keep in mind is that Governor Baker's administration has put a high priority on in-person learning here. So that might explain why the state is taking such a hard line right now.
And that hard line has been a particular sore spot, correct?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, it's this hard line on that policy. And then also Commissioner Riley's harsh response, it didn't really help. And that also got a lot of criticism. The Boston Teachers Union called it bizarre, and other teachers and parents have taken issue with the tone, too. One parent from the Curley School even created a change.org petition. And a lot of the signers, there were more than 2,000, commented that they felt that the state was kind of playing politics here.
So we talked with a Curley parent last week who didn't support the state's pushback on those remote learning days, but also felt that the Boston Public Schools and the school itself needed to improve communication. And as I understand it, the school did change some communication protocols in case of another outbreak. So is that true? And what are those changes?
Yeah, that is true. The Boston Public Schools is choosing now to talk to community members about a positive case right when they find out about it. In the past, they had been waiting until contact tracing was done, so only the close contacts would find out, and then they would tell the rest of the community. Now, it's as soon as they find out.
So we said at the top that this was a tale about two schools. So let's go to the other school now, which is in Hopkinton. We talk about COVID and schools. Masks are a huge piece of that conversation. They've been controversial in classrooms since the start of the year. I noticed you covered this. In Hopkinton, the high school there went mask-free for the first 3 weeks of November. It was a pilot, and cases didn't go up. So tell us about that.
Yeah, I think the big difference happening between these schools is that the Curley K-8 is an elementary school, and Hopkinton High School is it's a high school. And the difference is vaccinations. Hopkinton High School, those kids have been eligible for a really long time for their vaccinations, and that vaccination rate is 98%. That is
That's a high rate. Yeah.
That is a high rate, even for Massachusetts. And it's funny, when you talk to the town's health director, Sean McAuliffe, about this, he kind of takes it as a point of pride.
I don't know if a 54-year-old is allowed to say we killed it, but we killed it.
I mean, I think when he was describing to me what it took to get there, that pride is well deserved. His department, you know, visited people at their workplaces, they ran advertisements and everything in between. So, you know, the the vaccination rate shows all of that work.
So what are students and residents saying about the 3-week experiment?
Yeah, as you mentioned, it's a political issue, mask wearing. And that was definitely the case when it came to implementing this. The policy got mixed response on the school committee level first. And school committee members I spoke to said that the town was so deeply divided. There were some people who just were mad and, you know, that the school committee hadn't entertained the idea yet, that it took this long. And other people were mad that they were even entertaining the idea. And then, you know, when you talk to the students, too, those opinions also varied almost just as much. When I stopped by the high school, which was about halfway through this trial period earlier this month, there were still some students who said that they were opposed to this mask optional idea. But one thing that was interesting was the consistency with some of the other parts of their responses. And that's that, you know, almost everyone I talked to said that this trial has been kind of a morale boost. And here's how Senior Owen Schnorr described that.
A lot has surprised me. I think that how much has changed that we didn't even notice while we were wearing masks. Like, for example, like teachers, like we can't see their facial expressions, and that changes so much of teaching, which I didn't know that I would know until after. Like, for example, like, it's much more engaging when you feel like you have more of a connection with the teacher when you can see their facial expressions and see their almost emotion towards what they're teaching.
And yeah, like I was saying earlier, Schnorr isn't alone here. He was pro-mask policy trial, I mean. But even the students who were against it, or even students who couldn't take their mask off because they weren't vaccinated yet, they all just really appreciated having that opportunity to see at least a few more full faces during their school day.
So at this point, 18 school districts have applied for these waivers so that they can go temporarily mask-free. 11 of those waivers have been granted. Is this where we're going? Do you think more districts will apply and get the waivers granted?
I think so. More districts will apply and are applying for this. It's a two-step process, though. So part of it is applying to the state to even vote on that as a school committee. I think the harder part, the more political part here, is going to be passing it on the school committee level, which is why I think we're not seeing a wave of schools doing this right now. I think a lot of schools are kind of waiting to see what happens in Hopkinton, to see what studies have come out about spread, if it did lead to things down the road, and then we might start to see more of a wave.
So we are one Commonwealth. How can both of these stories be playing out in schools at the same time?
It's hard to say for sure, but what public health officials are telling me is the difference is vaccines.
Yeah. So one other thing. We know the issues in the Crowley School situation. One issue was access to sufficient testing, especially as the cases surged. Is there a statewide approach to testing, or is it sort of in school, by school? You know, where are we?
Somewhere in the middle. So the state does have recommendations, but there isn't a statewide policy or mandate, so to speak. Testing is kind of one of those areas where the state is deferring to local control here. But I do think you bring up a good point about capacity. There are capacity issues on several parts of this process. It's not having just the tests themselves. It's having the capacity among the people delivering the tests, like school nurses. They are already overwhelmed with a lot more on their plates because of COVID this year. Testing is just one of them.
Okay, so what do you watch, let's say, between now and the new year?
Yeah, I think the theme I'm seeing coming up more and more is vaccines. We've said that a lot today. And so I think it'll be interesting to see what happens among elementary schools and the spread of COVID there. Once more younger kids can get vaccinated, curious to see what happens to that rate.
All right. That is WBUR education reporter Carrie Young. Carrie, thanks.
You're welcome.
It is time to ask the doctors, and it feels like a big week for questions, doesn't it? Governor Baker says, enjoy your Thanksgiving. This year is a chance to get back to something that feels, quote, more like a traditional holiday, end quote. But then there's the numbers. Between November 12th and the 19th, the number of people hospitalized with COVID-19 went up 27%. And since the start of the month, the 7-day rate for people testing positive for the virus up a full percentage point, now over 3%. Are those conflicting messages? Are today's cases the same as the cases we saw last time the numbers were this high? Is it apples to apples? What questions do you have before you hit the skies or the roads for the Thanksgiving holiday and maybe gather with your family? Call 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We have two guests to answer your questions. You've gotten to know them both well since the start of the pandemic here. We have Dr. Helen Boucher, infectious disease physician at Tufts Medical Center and interim dean of the Tufts University School of Medicine, and Dr. Cassandra Pierre, acting hospital epidemiologist and an infectious diseases physician at Boston Medical Center. Dr. Pierre, welcome.
Great to be here. Thank you.
And Dr. Boucher, welcome to you too.
Oh, thanks so much for having me. Nice to be with you.
So Dr. Boucher, I'll start with you. Hospitalization numbers, they seem worrying. Infection numbers seem concerning. Another 6,800 cases over the weekend. Another 1,000 infection increases over last week, which was up from the week before. Wastewater numbers are up, and those tend to be an early indicator. What do you make of these numbers? Are there, you know, sort of psychic red alarm bells going off for you, or are you just still watching to see?
Well, I think perhaps a little of both, Tiziana. I think that we somewhat expected a bump after Halloween as the weather gets colder and people come indoors, and knowing that we still have a significant number of unvaccinated individuals in our state, despite the fact that we're close to 71% fully vaccinated. That means we're close to 30% not fully vaccinated. So this is not entirely unexpected, and I hope that it won't get significantly worse.
So, Dr. Pierre, I want to ask you the apples to apples question. You know, so the case numbers, the infection rate, the surges that we're seeing now, and I don't mean surge in an official term. I mean it as the generic term for increasing numbers. They think back to the last time our case numbers were at this level. Are we comparing apples to apples in the types of infections? I mean, I'm aware, for example, that we say a breakthrough case, you're not going to get as sick. You're less likely to be hospitalized or have fatality. So are these cases comparable to last time the numbers were like this?
I think it's important to know the perspective that you're looking at from a population level. Although these numbers are, as you say, rising, we know that there's a lot more people who have been vaccinated compared to the last time we saw numbers like this. And so our anticipation is that we will see less hospitalizations and much less deaths, particularly among those who've been fully vaccinated in this highly vaxxed or compared to the rest of the country, highly vaccinated region. For individuals who remain unvaccinated, however, it does remain a concern. We continue to see people, even young people, be hospitalized unnecessarily, to have severe complications, develop long COVID, and even unfortunately to die. So it really depends on the perspective that you're standing from. Overall, in this highly vaccinated population, we do feel like we have more tools at our disposal, and the most important ones are the vaccinations, to change a little bit what we've been seeing in terms of outcomes.
So what is the pressure on hospitals, Dr. Boucher? Some of the reporting that I have seen suggests that, you know, census is high in hospitals, but a lot of that is deferred care from before the pandemic. So is the COVID, are the COVID numbers right now taxing our hospitals, or are our hospitals taxed for other reasons or not taxed?
Yeah, well, Tiziana, our hospitals are taxed, and it is largely related to non-COVID disease. And as you pointed out, it's a lot of what we believe are the complications of deferred care for things like heart disease, cancer, and other illnesses. But if we layer on top of that the seasonal increases that we expect now that we're into the respiratory virus season in general, and then the COVID numbers on top of it, we're back into this predicament. And the governor issued a statement today advising hospitals to consider deferring elective surgery in order to care for the surge that is before us. And this is not a place that we like to be.
So I almost want to ask you, Dr. Pierre, how much should my heart clench when I hear the words that just came out of Dr. Boucher's mouth?
No, it definitely is concerning. We definitely don't want to be here again. It always feels like deja vu. We, however, do know that the more people who are getting vaccinated, those also now who have the opportunity of getting boosters, which is almost all of us, do have less of a risk of having to, you know, worry about coming into the hospital because of COVID-related issues. Getting our flu vaccines also helps reduce the risk of having predictable, preventable respiratory viruses causing us to come in with complications for care. But it is certainly not a situation that we want to be with. We are dealing with COVID and its after effects, and it continues to put a strain on our hospital system. Again, there are things that we can do to protect ourselves, but as a population, we still have not yet moved past this.
1-800-423-8255 to ask your question on Ask the Doctors. We have Kim on the line in Brookline. Go ahead, Kim.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. My quick question is, do we have any ideas when our older teenagers who were eligible for vaccinations in the spring will become eligible for a booster? Because right now it's still 18 up, but my 16 and 17-year-olds are not yet ready for their booster, but they could be due for it.
So, Dr. Boucher, thank you for the question, Kim. Dr. Boucher, I've heard this from a number of parents. If your child was vaccinated in April or May, they're a teenager. It's been 6 months now, but they don't qualify for boosters. Is there conversation about that happening?
Yeah, well, it's a really great question. And I have a 17-year-old daughter, so this is on my mind as well. And fortunately, some of the data that we've seen is quite reassuring that these young people have good antibody levels. And again, I'll remind you that we still don't know the so-called immune correlative protection. We don't know which antibody and what level of which antibody is most protective. But in general, we're seeing some signals that these young people are protected. And then remember, they also are less likely to become severely ill with COVID. All of that said, there is discussion about this topic, and I haven't heard a date yet in terms of recommendations, but stay tuned.
And let's stay with the phone calls, 800-423-8255. We'll go to Joan in Wellesley. Joan, go ahead.
Hi. I'm calling because I'm supposed to have my daughter and her partner over for Thanksgiving. He's from his first marriage, he has four kids, and one of the kids, 12 years old, her basketball coach just got turned positive for COVID. I'm 69 and immune suppressed. Everybody's vaccinated in this scenario. But my daughter said she could get the rapid test and do it. Those two could do it right before they come over on Thursday.
Joan,
is that enough?
Yeah. Are you worried about whether that's sufficient to have the granddaughter come over?
The granddaughter will not be coming over.
Okay, so it's the daughter.
He's going to meet with those four kids. It's just my daughter and her partner.
Got it.
But the partner is meeting with his four kids for breakfast.
Got it. Thank you. Dr. Pierre, your thoughts for Joan? And if you want me to summarize again, let me know.
No, that's fine, Joan. I know this is a complicated situation. It's like this really complicated recipe. What equals safety when we're out and living in the world? And this is going to continue to happen to a lot of us to figure out what our risk threshold is and what we can do to protect ourselves. So one of the things to know is that this daughter who has been exposed to the positive basketball coach is not, you know, hopefully is being tested, is getting tested on a recommended basis. And if she's vaccinated, her risk of infection presumably should be lower, but she should be tested as well. And they should pay close attention to any symptoms that might develop. In the interim, there are things for your daughter's partner to do to protect himself while having lunch, making sure he's seated at a suitable distance across the table, making sure there's good ventilation when he has breakfast. The thing to keep in mind, though, is that testing doesn't predict the future. So while I absolutely recommend getting tested and think that it is a new and important part of our holiday etiquette, if we have it accessible to us to lower our risk of transmitting to others. I would say that, you know, if he's going to have breakfast, he might want to, I think the thing to keep in mind is that there may be ongoing risk. Getting tested, however, is a really good way of lowering that risk. And the fact that everyone is vaccinated is an additional layer of protection.
So, Dr. Boucher, I want to stay on that for just a minute because, I mean, we had a conversation just yesterday about families navigating holidays together, and we're going to hear this more and more, the mixed vaccination status family and how those families think about gathering, how they set family policy, what is safe, what's not safe. Are you advising patients on this, and what kind of advice are you giving?
Well, we're certainly taking a lot of questions on this, Tiziana. And I think that there are a couple key concepts. One is everyone has to decide the level of risk they're willing to take. And in my mind, the safest is when everybody is vaccinated. And fully vaccinated people can really enjoy Thanksgiving, as Dr. Fauci and many others have said. When there is a mixture of vaccinated and unvaccinated individuals, then it becomes important to think about how much risk you're willing to take. If there are vulnerable people in the crowd, grandparents or other people with compromised immune systems, that is a consideration. And I think for sure, testing is another layer of protection, making sure there's good ventilation, windows are open, spacing is done, and other measures, even considering mask wearing, is reasonable. And I can't tell you, you know, what level of risk is right for you and your family. I think, you know, this information is meant to help make those decisions on a family-by-family basis.
So before I go back to the phone, staying with this one more time, Dr. Pierre, because you've both emphasized the importance of testing. We have also heard, you know, I know a number of people who have tried to buy at-home tests, can't get a hold of them. Tests in symptomatic and asymptomatic testing, some facilities are charging for those tests, others are not. So how does one affordably get a test, especially if you don't have symptoms?
I think that's an excellent, excellent question. Many of us have been really worried about the lack of availability of well-priced at-home tests. They are, to my knowledge, a little bit better stocked than they were a month ago. So that is better. The prices haven't changed, but they are, from what I can see, in better supply. But as far as how to get tested, there are, you know, depending on the city or the public health jurisdiction that you live in, your Department of Public Health should have links to local testing sites. So the Department of Public Health, and more locally here in Boston, Boston Public Health Commission, have links to active testing sites. In addition to that, retail sites, pharmacies, also have online ability to check availability of testing. I think that that is probably not sufficient, to be very honest, but it's a start. And so what I do encourage is people try and get tested or schedule their testing well enough in advance to be able to book it in. But it's something that absolutely needs to be improved. We need more testing resources.
Dr. Boucher, we've been talking about tests since, April of 2020. Why are we still in a shortage?
That's a great question. You know, I think the answer is complicated and as Dr. Pierre said, somewhat unsatisfying, but we still have supply chain issues and issues about who pays for what, which is, again, somewhat unsatisfying as we think about this. I will just mention that there are a number of places around our area, including at Tufts Medical Center, where testing is offered 6 days a week. And hopefully accessible, it's open to the public and accessible to everyone. So I just encourage people to do as Dr. Pierre suggested and look at your local Department of Public Health and what resources may be available closer to home. And, you know, in our professional society, we're working hard with the government to try to help increase the availability and the feasibility and cost of testing for everyone.
800-423-8255 to ask the doctors. Barbara is on the line in Carlisle. Barbara, what's your question?
Hi there. I got a J&J in March, and they're telling people that after 2 months, you kind of need a booster. So I'm figuring there's very little protection from that at this point, 8 months later. I was able to get a Pfizer, and I'm really looking at that as an initial vaccine at this point, and I would love to get a second Pfizer just so I feel protected and get the kind of coverage that we're seeking. It is also the case that I have ovarian cancer, so I've been undergoing treatment this whole year, and so I am at particular risk. Why can't I, I'm not able to get that second Pfizer because everyone tells me I've gotten my booster.
So, Dr. Pierre, the express question, why can't Barbara get a second booster? And with her particular circumstances, and again, I know you're not her personal physician, but based on what we heard, is it necessary?
I think this is a great and interesting question. So the first point is that I'm glad that you did get a second dose. And you got, you know, obviously this was important. We know that even before we had, when we were having these kind of risk categories for people who were at higher risk and therefore merited a booster prior to liberalizing it, we were saying that anyone who got a Johnson & Johnson should get their booster shot. And I think the problem that we have here is that there is we're running ahead of the data that is available to help support these decisions. We know that individuals who have received the Pfizer or Moderna and were felt to qualify for that definition of being immunocompromised were encouraged to get their third dose. And I'm now hearing that, you know, 6 months after, that third dose should get a booster as well. So it's a little unsatisfying. What I will say here is that, you know, we do know that we have evidence that with Johnson & Johnson, people who get that second dose, whether it be with the Pfizer or the Moderna or Johnson & Johnson, do have antibody levels that rise comparably when compared to individuals who've received other EUA-approved vaccines. And so I think that puts you in a really good position. What I would say is this is a kind of a gray area that really does need, unfortunately, to be discussed with your provider. I hear your concerns about immunocompromised status, and were you to have received the other two, you would have been eligible potentially for that third dose for immunocompromised individuals. So I think that's definitely something to talk about with your physician, figuring out what's possible. But in the situation, we're running ahead of the evidence that's available to support these decisions.
Let's pick up another call here. Fen in Boston. Hi, Fen. What's your question?
Hey there. I'm curious about, it's a transmission question, and I'm curious about potential transmission on the same day of exposure and what the likelihood is there.
So, Dr. Boucher, what do we know about that?
Right. Well, so I think what we know is that it takes time after exposure to become infected. And you need to be infected to transmit. So it's 2 to 5 days typically after exposure before you're infected.
What's the difference, Dr. Boucher, between being exposed and being infected?
Good question. So being exposed is coming into contact with a person who has the virus and inhaling it is the way you would typically be exposed. Being infected means that it's taken hold in your body and is causing infection. The thing to remember is you may know about one exposure, right? And that's what we're talking about, the exposure you know about. But most exposures are unknown. So it's not quite that simple. And in many times, people have been exposed unknowingly, and they are infectious before they develop symptoms. So this actually is quite a complicated issue.
So let's pick up one more call here. Jeff is in the car near Andover. Jeff, go ahead.
Yes, I have a quick question. I have two daughter-in-laws that are pregnant. They're both due December 19th and December 22nd. And everybody that's coming in for Thanksgiving has been vaccinated or boosted. And we're just wondering if it's warranted that they should still stay away because they're pregnant, because they've all been also had the vaccine.
All right. Well, first, I'm excited for you for the abundance of joy that's coming just before the new year, Jeff. And Dr. Boucher, Dr. Pierre, either of you on this one. Who wants to take this for Jeff?
I want to second those congratulations. I would say that similar to what Dr. Boucher said, you know, really, these decisions really have to be about made on an individual family level based on your risk tolerance. I'm glad to hear that everyone has been vaccinated. That significantly lowers risk. It doesn't completely eliminate it, though. And so the recommendation is that, you know, we continue to wear masks in indoor spaces when we're not around those family members that are meeting, that we try as much as possible to limit the number of people coming in, and that at our tables, we're, you know, it's going to be a nice day if you're in the area this Thursday, at least for New England or New England standards. So there is a possibility of opening up windows and having some ventilation. Again, I would encourage getting tested the day before, the day of, for all individuals to lower that risk. And the decision will have to be made on you know, all those factors, the ability to do those things and the risk threshold that you have.
All right. Well, I think on that note, that is Dr. Cassandra Pierre, acting hospital epidemiologist and an infectious diseases physician at Boston Medical Center. Thanks so much and happy Thanksgiving.
Happy Thanksgiving.
And Dr. Helen Boucher, infectious disease physician at Tufts Medical Center, interim dean of the Tufts University School of Medicine. Dr. Boucher, good wishes to you this week, too. Thanks so much.
Oh, thank you. Happy Thanksgiving.
We are talking stuffing for the rest of the hour. We're going to take your calls to fantastic chefs. The number is 800-423-8255. And before we turn to those chefs, we got Tom Keene on the line, friend of the show. Tom, hi there.
It's a pleasure to be on.
So I had to talk to you because you wrote this op-ed in the Globe this weekend, Tom, and you were dissing all food Thanksgiving, including stuffing, which you called soggy bread. I love stuffing, Tom. Why are you hating on it?
Oh, Tiziana, the whole point of stuffing was originally to help flavor a bird that's otherwise, let's face it, pretty dry and tasteless. So we load its guts with bread, herbs, and spices. And then someone got the crazy idea of actually eating this stuff. And I just remember growing up and watching the stuff being pulled out of the bird's cavity. Now, of course, we're not even supposed to put stuffing in the bird because the USDA says there's a risk of salmonella. So we have kept this tradition that was intended to make a bird taste good, and now we just have as a side dish that we cook in a pot.
Okay, so I want to play a little Green Eggs and Ham with you, because Would you, could you, if I gave you my grandmother's stuffing, which has pork sausage and Vienna bread and garlic and butter and white onion and clove, would you, could you then enjoy stuffing, Tom?
Well, probably not. But, you know, some of this, unfortunately, it's what we grow up with, right? And, you know, at a certain point, just seeing this stuff on the platter, kind of just a mound of whatever, really left me with a bad taste in my mouth. And I have to tell you, if stuffing was really that great, we'd be having it more than once a year. And that seems to me to be the most damning case against it. I agree that there are people who like it, but I think there's probably more people who think it's best confined to one fourth Thursday every year.
All right, Tom, you have set us up beautifully with those fighting words. And listen, listeners, we're going to link to Tom's op-ed on our website at radioboston.org. Tom, happy Thanksgiving despite the turkey and stuffing. Thanks for joining us.
Oh, it's the best holiday of the year. Happy Thanksgiving to you.
All right, so do you agree with Tom, or do you have very different feelings about stuffing? A recipe you want to share? Maybe an expletive? No expletives on air, but a strong feeling about disliking Thanksgiving stuffing, 1-800-423-8255. Joining us now, Joanne Chang, chef and owner of Flower Bakery and co-owner of the restaurant Myers and Chang. Joanne, welcome back.
Thank you so much for having me.
And I hear you're in a kitchen right now. Is that right?
I am. We are in full Thanksgiving mode, making pies, making stuffing.
Outstanding.
And just having a blast.
Outstanding. So we'll welcome that ambiance. We also have chef and co-host of the television show America's Test Kitchen, Bridget Lancaster. Bridget, hello.
Hi. It's so great to be back.
It is great to have you. So either of you, tell me, do either of you agree with Tom Keene and have this feeling that it's a disgusting thing that should not be eaten? I hear the chuckling.
I have to disagree with Tom, but I disagree respectfully. I think that maybe he hasn't had a great stuffing. I view stuffing as, honestly, even though it's a savory item, it's actually more like a pastry. To me, it is a bread pudding, which is a pastry item, but we make it savory. And I think it's spectacular, especially with turkey and chutney and gravy and all of the things that go along with a traditional Thanksgiving feast.
And Bridget, I heard your chuckle. It made me wonder, do you actually secretly agree?
No way. I was chuckling because all I could think of is Tom is my new challenge. I love stuffing. Where I grew up, we called it dressing because we didn't cook it inside of the bird. But no matter what you call it, I absolutely love it. One thing I will agree with, we should eat it more often.
Just full stop. Just drop the mic right there. Let's eat more stuffing.
That's it.
So listen, I'm going to grab our first call here. 800-4. This is such a blast. By the way, I just love stuffing. If I could handle the calories of the stuffing that we make in my house, we would eat it weekly. But oh my God. All right. 800-423-8255. Matt's on the line from Pembroke. Matt, go ahead.
Hi, how you doing today? I love listening to the chefs when you have them on, and I wanted to share a recipe that my father used to make in the 60s, and it's a fairly simple recipe but different. Using typical bag stuffing, which might not be the thing to do, but say a bag of Pepperidge Farm or something like that, but instead of doing butter in the water, you boil a pound of pork sausage, Italian sausage, and you keep the juices in there, and then you add the stuffing to that with celery and onion. But the key is you add one package of cooked 100% wild rice.
Interesting.
And then a bunch of slivered almonds.
Well, that sounds delicious, Matt. And I'm glad you brought up the rice thing because, A, Joanne Chang, I know you have a recipe that uses sticky rice in a stuffing. And, B, this year I know several people looking for stuffings that are gluten-free and wondering if rice is a way to do that. Amanda's on the other side of the glass in the control room raising her hand right now. So, Joanne Chang, over to you.
I love that idea. I think, adding the wild rice and adding the almonds is giving some great texture to the stuffing. And yes, if you're trying to go gluten-free, you could do an entirely rice stuffing. We make a sticky rice stuffing for the Thanksgiving holidays that uses glutinous rice. So when you cook it, it gets a little bit starchy and sticky. We put Chinese sausage and the onions and celery, and it's fantastic.
So Bridget, is there anything that has to be in stuffing for it to count or dressing? And thank you, by the way. I always wondered what the difference between stuffing and dressing was. It's stuffing if it's in the bird, dressing if it's cooked outside. I never knew that. So anything that has to be in it for it to kind of count as dressing or stuffing?
I don't think so. I do. Well, no, I'm going to go back on what I just said. I think it should have some sort of bulk. So the bread or the rice, I've seen bulgur dressings or stuffings. Anything like that is that's going to take up the bulk, because stuffing and dressing, they were originally kind of a similar to what Joanne was saying with them being a bread pudding. It was a use for stale bread or used ingredients, kind of giving them a second life. So I think as long as there's a backbone there, so the rice, the bread, cornbread, which is also gluten-free if it doesn't have any wheat flour, all those are great options.
Let's grab another call here, 800-423-8255. John's in Framingham. John, you want to recommend some other ingredients you like in stuffing, right?
Yes, I'm a graduate of the Henry O. Peabody School for 2 years, cooking and baking, chef school, worked in Boston at Anthony's Pier 4. I wanted to relay a great added thing to stuffing that's quick and easy to put together that my teacher from the Condon Public Schools was to add minced Macintosh apple to it to incorporate it, along with sautéed mushrooms and onions. And then you can add, if you wanted to try something basic, you could use your Arnold stuffing along with the butter that goes into it. One thing I wanted to let everyone know that this is a very unique thing. I'm of Albanian descent. My grandmother taught us what they call drop. Drop consists of two loaves of white stuffing bread, and you use two sticks of butter. You cube the bread, melt the butter into it, and then take it off the stove, just slightly brown it a little bit, and then you incorporate either the yellow or the brown raisins that goes into it, about a half a cup of chopped walnuts. And then also to give it more bountiful flavor, you add 8 tablespoons of turkey juice, and it's a big, big hit, and people really love it, called drop.
Thank you, John, and thank you for teaching us about drop, which I love. I love the name, and I love, love hearing about these recipes from family traditions. So out there, if you've got a family tradition for how you prepare stuffing or dressing or drop, call us, 800-423-8255. So we keep hearing crunchy, sweet, and savory, something like an apple or raisins, something like a nut. Joanne Chang, crunchy, sweet, and savory. How do we find the right blend of those things for a meal like a turkey dinner?
Well, I think you want to think about, the other items on the table. You've got the turkey, which is very, very savory and needs a little bit of, some might say there's a thing in the Globe today talking about whether or not we should even be eating turkey, but I love turkey and I think it's got a lot of great flavor. And so you want something to contrast with that. And you've got the rich gravy and the starchy potatoes and probably some vegetable. And so having a stuffing that does have that crunchy and the sweet and the savory and the fat, the caller before was talking about taking 2 loaves of bread and 2 sticks of butter. I think that's a crucial part of stuffing, is making sure it's got a lot of great, great fat, because that's what carries all the flavor. So I think it's all about just trying to balance out all of the different flavors on your entire table.
And Bridget, is there a way to cook it as stuffing safely? Tom was pointing out, we are advised not to cook that in a bird. So what's sort of the definitive word on that?
Well, it's true. There's a couple things that will happen. Of course, the turkey does flavor the stuffing, which is why so many people still want to stuff the turkey with stuffing. But it does prevent the turkey from cooking evenly. I mean, turkey, the architecture of a turkey is already, you know, a mystery. I don't know how it got put together as it did, but it's hard to get the breast meat to cook at the same rate as the dark meat. And then when you pack the cavity full of stuffing, it can really complicate things. So one thing that we have suggested people do is there are turkey stuffing bags. They're a cheesecloth bag, or you can use cheesecloth. You can put some of the stuffing in there and put it in the turkey. But before you do that, you want to heat the stuffing in the microwave and get it a little closer to a hot temperature before it goes into the bird. That way, it's not going to prevent the bird from being overcooked before the stuffing is a nice, safe temperature.
I had no idea. That's fascinating. I may try that. All right. We've got Yasue on the line in Needham. Go ahead.
Hi there. When I was growing up, my mom, who's Mexican, she used to make a stuffing that had absolutely, I don't think it had any carbs in it now that I think about it, but it had chopped up green olives and veal and chopped ham and chicken broth and slivered almonds. And I just was curious if that, is that maybe a Spanish dressing? I mean, no one, you know, when I was growing up, I was always like, can't we just have stovetop? I didn't really appreciate it until I got older. And it's really delicious. And I was just curious if anyone knew about that kind of a dressing.
So, Joanne Chang, have you ever heard of something like veal, ham, almonds, green olives, chicken broth?
I haven't, but it sounds amazing. I mean, all of those flavors, again, I think would be great with turkey and, you know, and some of the other more traditional items on a Thanksgiving table. I don't know that I would necessarily call that a stuffing or a dressing as much as some sort of condiment, it sounds like, or even like a side dish, but I think it sounds great.
What would you season it with?
I think that has such strong flavors already. I don't know that it would need much more than, you know, maybe a little bit of sage or a little bit of, you know, I would pick like one herb, maybe oregano, and then obviously, you want to make sure you season it well with salt and pepper.
And yes, Wei, do you know what kinds of seasonings your mother used?
We were hunting for her recipe. She passed away 5 years ago this month. So, and my brother was asking me about it. And so I think they're hunting for it in the house. It could be oregano. And but it was really, really savory and delicious.
I hope you find it. I really do. You know, I lost my grandmother years ago, and being able to cook those recipes now make a difference. So we'll be thinking of you. Let's pick up Arlene in Lawrence. Arlene, go ahead.
Go. Thank you for taking my call. You know, hearing all these spices and stuff, we as Puerto Rican household growing up, we, you know, outdid it with the spices as far as saffron, oregano, and listening to her with the olives. But we accompany our turkey with rice and what we say in Spanish, gandules, which is pigeon peas. And it is to die for.
It sounds fantastic. Let's pick up one more here. Ed in his car on the North Shore. Ed, briefly, you have a couple of ingredients you'd like to recommend.
Yes, I take a sage and onion commercial breading, add apples, oranges, and onions. The sweet onions chopped into half-inch pieces, also raisins and cranberries. And to get the taste of the turkey, I use turkey broth instead of putting it in the bird.
All right. Thank you so much for that, Ed. So two calls there, and I think we'll go back. Puerto Rican side dishes, different spices, traditions from around the world that can really flavor up what, you know, an American Thanksgiving meal. Bridget, thoughts there?
I love it. It's just such a, even if you have a classic, and I have big quotation marks up when I say classic, recipe with the sage and the thyme and maybe a breakfast sausage, you can really start to switch things up and you can add a different type of sausage, a chorizo, an andouille. You can add in pimentos. You can add in mushrooms, all these different things, dried fruit, olives. I'm trying to write down all these ideas as people are saying them. Olives are probably going to go into my next one. It's just such a huge flavor punch. I love all this. This is just such a great way to add new flavors or incorporate different flavors than are traditionally at your table.
So if you're going to try adding something like olives, Joanne Chang, do you just put them in big or small, something with that powerful of flavor? I'm a huge olives fan. Chop them up, cook them first, just bake them right in a dressing or stuffing. Tell us what you think.
I would definitely chop them up so that you don't get a bite that's one big olive, because like you said, it is very strong. But I agree. I think it would be such a great flavor addition to a stuffing. And you know, you could do what we always do here at the bakery, which is whenever we make a new recipe, we always start off with a tiny, tiny little batch. So make like a tiny little bit with whatever your starch is, whatever your, you know, if you're adding a nut or if you're adding dried fruit or, you know, anything else, and then add a little bit of olive and see how much you want to add, because different olives have different brininess, and different people have different tolerance for olives or a like of olives. So I would taste a little bit before you go big.
Okay. And Bridget, I noticed many people who called had nuts of different kinds for that crunch, but we know there are a lot of people with nut allergies. Is there something one could use instead of a nut that would really deliver that to a stuffing, but be more, less risky, especially if you don't know the allergy needs of everybody coming to your table? Mm.
That's a really good point. I would say something like fried chickpeas would be great, tossed in.
That sounds pretty good.
Yeah, does that sound like the spiced and fried chickpea? And then that goes back to that kind of pigeon peas and rice idea as well. So mm-hmm. you still have that bulk going in there. But other things, dried peppers, something that's been kind of sautéed, crisp mushrooms going in that have been almost over caramelized. And I've got to say it. I mean, crispy bacon makes everything better.
So, Joanne, I hear you chuckling there. Anything you'd add on that front?
Yeah, no, I was going to say, I love the crispy bacon idea. I think that's so smart. I also think you can bake the stuffing or the dressing so that it has a nice crunchy top. You know, you don't necessarily need to have an item ingredient inside the stuffing that adds that crunch. But if you bake it nice and long and it gets that crunchy top, maybe even put a little bit of cheese on top, then that can really add a great texture.
All right. So lightning round, because we're almost out of time. Bridget, the favorite dish on the table besides the dressing?
Oh, my goodness. I would have to say that, well, that's coming at dessert. That's the pecan pie.
Yeah,
definitely.
I'm good with that. That sounds fantastic. And Joanne Chang, how about you?
I'm going to say the same. Not pecan pie necessarily, but a dessert. Pear and cranberry crostata.
No, say that again. Pear and cranberry crostata?
Exactly. It's an open face pie that's filled with ginger roasted pears, fresh cranberries, and almond cream. It's incredible.
Well, clearly we're having the two of you back to do pies soon. That's Joanne Chang, chef and owner of Flower Bakery and co-owner of the restaurant Myers and Chang. Joanne, thanks.
Thank you so much.
And Bridget Lancaster, chef and co-host of the television show America's Test Kitchen. Bridget, thanks so much.
Thank you. Happy Thanksgiving.
Thanks, you too. That is our show for today, folks. Radio Boston's a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. Thanks for listening and calling. I'm Tiziana Deering. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.